All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. How's it going, Santa War Radio? I'm Scott Horton.
I'm Zoe Greif. Here we are.
Yeah, it's the radio show.
Doing the show, yeah.
Hey, man, you know who it's been too long since we talked to on the radio show?
Lots of people, but who are you talking about?
Bob Murphy.
There you go.
I like Bob Murphy.
I like his books.
I also like his books. I've read both of them.
I've only read one, but I liked it a lot.
I should have been reading his blog this morning. I'm going to have to catch up. In fact, I will pull it up right now. Consulting by RPM.com. The thing is, what made me want to bring him on the show was this thing I saw about Ben Bernanke saying to a group of young people, "Yeah, I know you like Ron Paul, but the gold standard is stupid. And let me count the ways." And so I thought, well, maybe I'll get Bob Murphy on to talk about what Ben Bernanke says and see if we can come to a consensus about what must be the truth around here when it comes to things like that. Let's see. So consulting. Yes, that's how fast I type. By RPM.com. There we go. Free Advice is his financial blog. Oh, and I should open up Writings in case he has something new out at Mises.org or anything like that. I don't know. No, it doesn't look like it. Unless it's in reverse chronological order. All right, well, anyway. So, the Free Advice blog. Murphy on Mises on money is the top entry. Sounds good. All right, so that's going on. Aren't you stoked?
Hell yeah.
Also, Kelly Vallejos. Hey, Bob's got a new podcast thing going on, says Sid Ishus. Really? I didn't know that. We should, where the hell is it? Video clips, Murphy in motion. That's funny. I don't see it. Somebody show me. Maybe I need to allow all on this page first. Maybe not. Came across on his Facebook. 1 second. Says Sidious in the chat room. All right. Well, anyway. That's good to know. New podcast, huh? Also, Kelly Vallejos will be here to talk about Washington, D.C. and what it's like living there and around those weird people with all the terrible wrong things they believe in and stupid, ridiculous things that they say out loud to each other. She's been observing some of that lately. I know that's a bit broad, but we are talking about the national government and the empire, of course, so. Anyway, that should be fun. Kelly Vallejos from antiwar.com. And also this guy, Lawrence Whitner. I don't have his bio in front of me. Yeah, I do. Wait a minute. All I gotta do is clickety-click on a couple of things here. Here we go. Lawrence Whitner is an award-winning American historian, writer, and activist for peace and social justice. He's a professor of history emeritus. Obviously, I'm not at SUNY Albany. His latest book is Working for Peace and Justice, Memoirs of an Activist Intellectual. LawrenceWhitner.com. Well, anyway. It's a very highfalutin bio, but it's a very down-to-earth article about how, hey man, do we really need all these nuclear weapons? And you know what? You do not have to be a patchouli stinking hippie to think that either. All reasonable people think, we really need all these nukes? And the only people who disagree with that? Unreasonable. That's right. Why? Because I say so.
Maybe they have stock in, who actually builds the nukes? Is it Raytheon? Is it, I'm
all
not sure.
All of them. I don't know. You know what? There was an article. There was a guy I interviewed one time from something called the Los Alamos Study Group or something, which is a group of anti-nuclear activists that live outside of, you know, who moved near Los Alamos just to be against it, I guess.
That's
and anyway,
ironic.
He wrote a thing that was all about all of the welfare for the nuclear weapons industry in the Senate's amendments to the START Treaty. And it was madness. I wish I could recite all the stuff off the top of my head for you here, but it was Well, hell, I don't know. Let's Google my name. Scott Horton and Los Alamos Study Group and maybe radio. And then, so, yeah, Darwin Bond Graham was his name. Here we go, November 4th, 2002. And then his article that we ran at antiwar.com is called New Start. Arms Affirmation Treaty. And in fact, there's another one just like it, called New Start's Big Winners, U.S. Nuke Complex, Pentagon, and Contractors. So, Zoe.
Yeah.
That's my answer to your question. I don't know the answer to your question, but I do know two great footnotes where you could start answering that question. It's Darwin Bond Graham, which is one word, Bond Graham. At antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/bondgram. Really? And he's got two articles, both of them in answer to what Zoe just asked. Who's making the money off of all the hydrogen bombs being made? Can you imagine that's your job? Bye, honey. I'm going off to work. My job is to go lobby Congress to build more hydrogen bombs simply because I get paid. That's my work. I ain't got no strategic reasons why it ought to be so, but damn it, I got a mortgage, so I'm going to go lobby for more thermonuclear weapons. Okay. That's the public choice theory of the apocalypse. Lawrence Whitner will be on the show to advise against it. Thank goodness. Alright. Now, I'm happy to say that Friday I will be hosting this book salon thing at Fire Dog Lake. And it's going to be about this book. What the hell did I do with it? Just had it. I think it's War No More, isn't it? It's about how, hey, it doesn't have to be this way. Oh, yeah, there's always been war. There always will be. Not necessarily. It's starting off strong. I haven't gotten all the way through it yet, but maybe I'll read it tonight or something. It's not very long. And then I need to do a little bit of research about what exactly does it mean to host a book salon at Fire Dog Lake. They do this all the time. I have never participated in one. I really don't know how it works. So I'm going to have to, like, I guess just Google up some old book salons at Fire Dog Lake and kind of see how they went. I'm hosting for the author of the book. I guess that means...
Is it like a Skype thing?
I ask him some of the questions. The chat room people, blog commenter, participators ask some of the questions themselves. Maybe I'm in charge of picking and choosing which ones he ought to bother answering or something.
Are you
going to
be
on
Skype or are you just moderating this?
No, I like don't think it's Skype.
Email
it's,
debate? Or...
We're all going to be on one big chat room together. Although, damn it, Zoe, I don't know.
Okay, man.
I have
fair
no
enough.
Idea.
You're the one hosting. I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, it's only Thursday, so so thank goodness for that. I will see if I can figure out what in the hell. Okay? And then I will be hosting. It'll be like an interview, only different. Basically. Like an interview, but different. Yeah. I'm also pleased to announce that got my new laptop up and running after the hot chocolate incident. So it's supposed to be the backup recorder, but actually I forgot to hit the button. And that means the one that was substituting as my backup recorder can now be devoted to attempting to transcribe these things. And then maybe I can cheat and make articles out of my out loud complainings. It's an experiment. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. And You know who's hilariously pathetic is Democrats.
Yep.
They're just horrible.
All you have to do is step outside your door in Austin, Texas, and look around, and you'll see some.
Man. So, I put out a thing on the Twitter, which I hate. It's so stupid, Twitter. I put out this thing on Twitter saying, everybody's all worked up about this guy murdering this black kid in Florida. Good. That's what they should be. Wannabe cop murders an unarmed kid. Off with his head. In fact, I'm kind of impressed that the death of an individual citizen in America has become a national news story, and it's not a young blonde girl. So, something bad happened to a young black person, and America cares? Well, fucking right on, man. Good. Now, what about all the blacks in Libya that Obama has had rounded up and raped and murdered and tortured and caged in the zoo? What about that? How come all the liberals who care so much about the death of this kid at the hands of a wannabe cop down in Florida don't care at all when Barack Obama, the grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, leads a massive anti-black pogrom in Libya? How come they don't care? Aren't they liberals or aren't they? Are they or aren't they? No, they're not. You know what they are? They're Democrats. And what does that mean? That means Barack Obama could be going into those refugee camps and raping those women himself. And they don't care. They love it. Pepe Escobar writes in the Asia Times, comes on this show to report to you that the military commander of the Libya rebels is a guy named Hakim al-Belhaj, who is a jihadist who fought with the Taliban against America in Afghanistan, and then with al-Qaeda in Iraq against America in Iraq, and now he's leading the military forces there. David Enders can come on the show from McClatchy Newspapers. He wrote an article like this. He came on the show to report to you. He was in the refugee camp. He was interviewing the women who were being raped because they're black at the hands of the rebels in Libya. Obama's rebels. Obama's rebels that are friends with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. These warring militias of madmen who, when they found Gaddafi, just put him on his knees and shot him in the back of the head. Which, not that he really deserved any better than that, but they are supposed to be better than doing that to him is the point, but they're not. And if you go to RT right now, you can see, if you can stand it, black men rounded up at the zoo, in cages at the zoo, being taunted, having their bound, of course, with green Libyan, I guess, flags shoved down their throats. Yeah, some guys at Guantanamo died like that. Anyway, this is the president, you liberals, so-called, Democratic Party supporters, support. Oh, Barack Obama. You know what? He could drop nuclear bombs and kill every man, woman, and children in Africa, and you'd still love him. You'd still come to me talking about how he's showing toughness and resolve like Truman. It's the only way to defeat al-Shabaab. It's because of anti-war people like you, Scott Horton, that prevented Obama from sending in the army, so we had to use nukes, you'll say. I actually got a tweet back from this guy saying, how can you compare the murder of a person in Florida to the foreign policy of the president? One guy kills one guy in Florida. Now that is horrifying. Barack Obama backs al-Qaeda in a war against his former friend, Muammar Gaddafi, gets thousands of people killed, and has created this, or at least allowed, took the lid off the pot of this horrible race problem in Libya that has now all come to the fore. How can you compare those things? People being, you know, all the women being dragged out of the refugee camp in the middle of the night and gang raped. That's not horrible. That's foreign policy. That means it's okay. Barack Obama did it. That's okay. The guy wastes his whole tweet telling me what an idiot I am. He actually didn't make his point other than it's foreign policy, which has packaged inside it, I guess. So it's fine. It's a decision made by a politician, so that's different. Only, yeah, I don't think it is. And then now, look at this war, and we've seen this coming for weeks and weeks.
Oh, yeah.
The Tuareg rebels who had left Mali to go and be mercenaries for Gaddafi, which is part of the excuse of these rebels picking on all blacks in Libya, is that, oh, they must all be mercenaries, even though, of course, 99% of them probably are just laborers and people who are actually just from there, right? But, oh, no, you know, Gaddafi hired darker-skinned people to be in his little private Gestapo. And so, anyway, a lot of them went home when the war came, and they went home to Mali. Only they had all these weapons that they got from Gaddafi that they kept when they went home.
And some battlefield experience that they didn't used to have.
Exactly. And so they decided, let's go overthrow the government there. Well, now the military of Mali has overthrown the government and become it, complaining that the president, whatever his exact title was, apparently the guy had been elected a few times, he's not doing enough to protect us from the rebels, they complained. And so now, look, man, it's fair and it's correct. It's right of you to say, where the hell is Mali? I mean, it sounds far away. Does anybody exactly know? It must be over there somewhere near Chad in the Sahara Desert. I don't have a map of Africa in front of me. Think I know my geography that well? It's somewhere south of Libya. How about that? They left Libya, they went home, and now a democratically elected sort of kind of leader has been overthrown in a military coup as just one part of the blowback of Obama's war in Libya. And you know what? I'm not an expert on Mali, but I did read a piece in the Reuters this morning and said this guy took over in a military coup himself back a generation ago, but then he stood for election. He took off his general's uniform, and he put on civilian clothes, and he stood for election at least twice since then. And no, that doesn't make him great or his government legitimate, but it's better than a military junta, which is what they got now. But, man, what was the one? I forgot, Zoe. I'm kind of blowing it, because I forgot the funniest defense of Obama that I got in my thing here. Oh, yeah, Obama did not pass the law that protects Zimmerman. Jeb Bush did. So how can you attack Barack Obama? Even though I said Libya in the damn thing. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest on the show today is Bob Murphy. Robert P. Murphy to you. He keeps the blog Consulting by RPM.com. He's a fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. Very important lessons for your brain in there. And also The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, which I could not recommend more highly to those of you who's got a friend with that anti-capitalist mentality who thinks that what we really need is just the right mix of socialism and everything will be just right. And you give them this book and it'll fix their wrong head. Welcome back to the show, Bob. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Scott. I'm doing well.
Good. Very happy to have you here. I saw this hilarious article and I thought of you. It's called Bernanke Schools, Ron Paul's Potential Fans on the Gold Standard. Now, I didn't click all the links here. Maybe there's video, but I can imagine it. Now, you kids, I know you like Ron Paul, but really the gold standard is stupid, and let me count the ways. And let's see. Among the arguments Bernanke made Tuesday, this is at yahoo.com, this news story. Among the arguments Bernanke made Tuesday, the gold standard requires us to waste resources by mining gold in Africa and shipping it here. It connects nations' currencies, which exposes us to monetary policy in other countries. And it leads to deflation. So I guess let's just start with the waste. It is easier to print a dollar than to dig up a bar of gold, so he sounds like he's got a real good point there, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the standard argument against the gold standard. And even going back to, like, Adam Smith, you know, economists were aware of that. But as you say, it's a trade-off involved. So, sure, if we could restrain the government from printing money through some other mechanism, then we should consider that. But you're right. If the issue is, okay, if they're stuck on the gold standard, then we're going to have some resources are going to be used digging it up and then storing it to back up the dollar or whatever the currency is. Or we'll just take all the constraints off and let them print as much money as they want. That's sort of a foolish bargain to be making, that the waste caused by the housing bubble and what we're doing right now and so forth. I mean, that's just dwarfs the waste of, oh, man, we had to use some workers and some tractors and other things to get some gold and move it across the ocean to some vault somewhere. I mean, that's nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it couldn't possibly be much. I mean, how big of a ship do you need to move gold, right? Not an oil tanker.
Right.
All right. So then, now this one, I kind of always meant to ask you this, or maybe Ron Paul or somebody like you on the show. It seems to be a good point. It connects nations' currencies. The gold standard would connect nations' currencies, which exposes us to monetary policy in other countries. Like, say, for example, the BRICS wanted to conspire against us. They could dump all of their gold onto the market, and that would drive down the value of our dollar. They would have control over our monetary policy instead of our own loyal, patriotic open market committee.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not even sure exactly what Bernanke was getting at there, because really what's happening, if a bunch of nations are on the gold standard, then really they're just tying their own currencies to gold itself. So, yeah, I guess it is true that indirectly if one nation tries to do something, it affects the other ones. But that was kind of the point of the classical gold standard, was that it kept everybody honest, that if one nation started inflating while everybody else, you know, maintained the status quo, then pretty soon, you know, its gold reserves would flow away from that country and into the vaults of the other countries. And so if it wanted to stay on the gold standard, it would have to abandon its inflationary policy. So, you know, it's a bit like saying, you know, oh, we don't want to have rules in basketball because then if we commit a foul, the referee's going to call it. And it's going to, you know, constrain us. You know, so, I mean, yeah, there is that aspect to it. But in any event, that's...
Well, what about as like a subtle act of war, or not so subtle act of war, where, you know, I don't know, the EU and the Russians and the Chinese and, I don't know, invent a new continent with some enemies on it, because we're friends with all of those people. But anyway, the mystery Atlantis continent comes back and they're our enemy and they dump a bunch of gold as a way, like a passive-aggressive move against the United States. You're saying that that'll hurt them enough that it'll keep them from doing it, or what?
Well, I mean, for one thing, that would be incredibly expensive, right? I mean, because they'd have to first acquire the gold and then dump it, and so that would be a pretty expensive move. And right, it's not, I mean, they can do things like that right now. I mean, so there are countries that have been complaining about the Federal Reserve's monetary policies the past few years, saying, you know, gee, when you guys print up so many new dollars, if we didn't do anything, then the dollar would, then our currencies would strengthen against the dollar in the foreign exchange markets, and that would hurt our exports. And so, in a sense, you got like a lot of these Latin American countries that are implicitly forced to devalue their own currencies so that their exports don't get hurt in the short run.
Right.
You know, when I mean,
it's not just them, right? So the whole world has to inflate in time with the United States, basically.
Well, right, but I mean, it particularly strikes countries that have just a few major exports, you know, that they're really dependent on that, and that their commodities, which, you know, the prices adjust very quickly based on currency movements. So, but you're right, it's everybody, but those particular countries that are kind of small and they're relying on just selling like one or two things into the world market to then buy everything else, they're particularly vulnerable. So, I get, you know, my point is, it's you don't avoid that problem by having floating fiat currencies. You still have this issue that if a bunch of countries really were out to get you, and we're willing to hurt themselves, to try to inflict some collateral damage on your country, they could do it right now by running their printing presses, and that would cause disturbances. So again, the point is, if you want to constrain the ability of everybody to do things with monetary policy, including using it as a weapon, well, then you're better off if everybody is saying we have to redeem our currency in a certain number of units of gold. You see what I mean? Like, that's constraining what they can do.
Right. Well, of course, right? But that's the whole thing, is you and I are both coming from that libertarian premise where we want to constrain all these different states' powers. That's why we want to tie the dollar to gold that way, or at least, you know, new privately made currencies. We want them tied to gold because we call it, you know, honest money, and we also want our government that limited. But I guess what Bernanke's saying is, you know, he comes from a different premise where the government is to be as big as Congress says, and that's great, or whatever, and that, I guess maybe that's sort of his point, why he's against gold. We need paper money in order for the government to be big enough and do what it wants. A gold standard wouldn't work for the world empire, or for even the national empire that we have.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of his worldview is that he thinks there are situations where the economy could benefit from a huge expansion of the money supply. So, you know, he thinks that's true in the early 1930s, that the U.S. was desperately in need of a huge expansion of money. And he thinks that that was, you know, the case in 2008. And it was, phew, it was a good thing that Bernanke's hands weren't tied by the gold standard, right? So he was able to double the quantity of base money in a few short months. Right, so that's his worldview. Whereas I and other Austrian economists typically don't think that the Great Depression was caused because there wasn't enough inflation by the Fed, for example. So yeah, if in your mind the central bank has a big responsibility and has to use massive bursts of inflation once in a while to avoid disaster, then you're going to be very depressed if all of a sudden there's all these shackles put on the discretion of central bankers. But if you're like me and you think, no, it's the central bank that causes these massive boom-bust cycles, then you do want to have shackles put on or get rid of the central bank altogether.
Right. And call waiting, man. Sounds wrong. I ordered no call waiting, please, but I got it anyway, and it's sounding terrible. All right, well, geez, I guess I'm going to talk about you and who you are and what you do a little bit, because we're almost at the break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about deflation and inflation and other interesting stuff with Robert P. Murphy from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. That's Mises.org. His website is consultingbyrpm.com. Robert P. Murphy there, Consulting by RPM. Free advice is the name of the blog. And he's also got a YouTube channel, Bob Murphy ANCAP, at YouTube.com. We'll be right back. All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing here. It's Anti-War Radio. Talking with Robert P. Murphy from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Ben Bernanke, this guy in charge of the Federal Reserve, its chairman, he thinks he's smart. So far, he made, well, according to, and I didn't see the whole speech, but according to this news story, he took a shot at Ron Paul, basically, because there were some young people in the audience, and so he was kind of being patronizing and saying, oh, I know you like Ron Paul, but here's why he's not right at all. And according to this article, his arguments were, oh, it costs so much to dig gold out of the ground. Bob Murphy dispenses that quickly with, yeah, well, having a massive boom and bust and losing trillions and trillions of dollars in this horrible so-called business cycle economy of yours costs more. And then other nations, why they could manipulate the gold market and affect our currency. Yeah, well, other nations can manipulate their currency and affect our currency right now anyway. And so there's so much for that. And now what we're left with is that it will lead to deflation. Now, I don't know his exact words. It's not in quotes here. Maybe he said falling prices. Maybe those things are the same thing. Maybe they're not. What do you say, Bob?
Well, I mean, Bernanke, when he says the word deflation, he means falling prices. That's one of the arguments, and they think that there are various reasons that falling prices are a bad thing, because, oh, you know, wages are sticky, so if product prices fall, then businesses can't afford to keep hiring workers, so they have to lay people off because, it's you know, they can't just cut wages to the same extent. So there's various arguments, and that's why Bernanke said it was so critical in the last few years that he be able to inject all that money in, because they had to stave off this deflationary threat in his mind. So in general, no, I think that's a terrible argument. I don't believe that the early 1930s were so bad because of falling prices, and I've done some work in Tom Woods and others that, if, for example, in 1920 and 21, there was also a depression. They used a small D back then, and in the first 12 months of that depression, prices fell far more than they fell in the same time period in the beginning of the 1930s. All right, so falling prices per se don't spell disaster. What happened last time, the reason that it wasn't such a big deal last time is that, you know, in the 20s, was that wages fell too, right? So the issue is there was some reason that wages were all of a sudden sticky in the 30s, and there's various things like the strength of labor unions and the Hoover administration and others were doing things behind the scenes to tell businesses don't cut wage rates and various things. So I think a free market by itself can have flexible prices, and if you have falling prices, that's not the end of the world, and we see throughout history that's, you know, it can't be that the Great Depression was caused by falling prices. So I think that's just another bogus argument that Bernanke was using.
Well, I don't understand. Bob, are the masters of the universe really that stupid? The falling prices, like you say, you look at last time, there was a big fake bubble that Greenspan and Bernanke built up. The falling prices was the result of the scam no longer working, the curtain being pulled aside, and prices trying to seek level. Right?
Yeah, that's a great point, too, that if what you're concerned about is you don't ever want to be in a situation where to restore equilibrium, prices across the board need to fall 10%, well, then don't pump in a bunch of money beforehand, and then you won't ever find yourself in that situation.
Yeah, so, exactly. They're always talking about the symptoms of the disease they got and how, I guess, more what made them sick is the only treatment they can think of.
Yeah, and it's, you know, when you say, can these guys be that dumb? I mean, obviously, you and I think, are on the same page when, above a certain level, I mean, I think they have Bernanke out there because they tell him this is what the policies are going to be, and you come up with whatever academic spin you want to give it.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. We're so, stealing this money. You tell them why.
Right. So, I mean, now, I do think there are plenty of people who genuinely believe in the sorts of, you know, the theoretical framework and blah, 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 but yeah, I mean, above a certain level with the people who are actually in positions of power, I don't think it's just that they're making an honest intellectual mistake and we have to just keep trying and eventually they'll see the light. Mm-hmm. I think that these policies are driven by the interests of the bankers, and Bernanke's job is to, like I say, to justify it using some sort of theoretical framework.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now, I guess maybe I went off the story there with my contempt for the man, when I should have stuck more to the point. You're telling me that falling prices, if it's not the bust part of the boom-bust cycle, but we just have a gold currency, obviously, that inflates very slowly as people are mining, you know, more gold and that kind of thing, that falling prices in those circumstances, all things being equal, are okay. It's only the problem is when it's a crash, and then they point to falling prices during a crash, and they say, see, we don't ever want falling prices. Look how horrible that is.
Right. I think that's right. That there, so, yes, there are periods in history where if you go and look and, gee, prices are falling a lot, and the economy's awful, and so they think that the one causes the other, when, no, it's more the other way around, that periods when the economy is crashing are also when, if you don't have fiat money getting pumped in at the same time, prices are going to come down too.
Mm-hmm.
So what's ironic is even in like 1926 and 1927 in the United States, prices, the consumer price index, was gently falling. Right, so you had falling prices then, and that was in the middle of, you know, the roaring 20s when everybody thinks the economy, you know, either was healthy or was overheating. Mm-hmm. So it's what happens is in a normal economy, if production keeps increasing and the quantity of money either is constant or grows more slowly than the quantity of output, well, then in general, the price per unit is going to go down. But that's perfectly fine. Businesses can still maintain their margins because they're able, to sell more stuff, right? If the workers get more productive, and so now with their given workforce, they can crank out 10% more widgets, then the businesses can afford to have the widget price fall by 5%, and that's fine because they're cranking out that many more. And so they still maintain their margins, and workers then, even if they have the same paycheck, it can now go farther at the store. So everybody's standard of living goes up. That sort of gentle price deflation is fine. And you saw that throughout various stretches of U.S. history when the dollar was tied to gold or silver.
In other words, the prices of goods are tied to the supply and demand of the goods, not mostly the money that's being used to trade in the goods, the way it is now.
Well, it's the interaction, right? So this is a little bit of a crude way to think about it, but I mean, if the total amount of stuff...
Well, I'm a vulgar Austrian here. I never took all the classes. Yeah. I really wish I did.
But. Yeah, I mean, if it's the total amount... what I'm saying is it's the interaction between the two. So if the total amount of cars is going up at 10% a year, and the number of dollar bills is only going up at 3% per year, over time, you would expect that, you know, dollars now can buy more cars, right? So the price of a given car in dollars would come down over time, right? So, I mean, if you just extrapolate that to goods across the whole economy, mm-hmm. if more and more stuff is physically produced every year, and that pile of stuff grows faster than the pile of dollars chasing those goods, mm-hmm. then prices tend to go down. But what happens now with fiat money is, the amount of dollars tends to rise faster than the amount of stuff. And so that's why, you know, price stickers keep going up and up and up year after year.
Right. Well, now, okay, so if they mined all the last of the gold and there was no more to dig out of the ground, it had all been turned into jewelry or industry or bricks for the vaults somewhere, would it make sense then to just have a gold standard forever and never let the supply of money increase from now on, and prices will just always fall for everything from now on? Till the end of history?
At some point, maybe it would make more sense to switch to some other commodity to be the base. I don't know.
Don't ever need to expand the base of the money supply, no matter how much expansion in the economy is going on.
Right, exactly. That there's nothing, I mean, once people adjusted to the new situation, that would just mean that maybe prices, instead of falling at 1% per year, would in general fall at, you know, 2.3% per year. Mm-hmm. And once people knew to expect that, that would be fine, and they would just build that into their long-term contracts, and workers would know that, yeah, my wages go down a little bit every year, but prices go down even faster. So every year, my paycheck can buy more and more at the store. You know, right. So once people adjusted to that, it wouldn't be a big deal. And then moreover, there'd be a lot more stability because people would know no central bank can come along and cause a massive boom-bust cycle. That we have the stability built into it.
Right, and that's the real trick, is as long as you don't have all these distortions and speculative bubbles that pop and leave so many people stranded the way this last crash just ruined so many people.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think that's part of the problem, too, right now, that it's sort of an unseen cost of Bernanke's policies and the other central bankers, too, is that right now, I mean, just look at how many of your listeners and the people that I associate with. We might be crazy, but we're worried about a massive inflationary outburst in the near future. And so they're doing stuff like stocking up on gold and silver and all sorts of other – engaging all sorts of hedges to protect themselves instead of just, you know, if you're a business person trying to please your customers, or if you're just trying to get ahead at work and – you know what I'm saying? So now we're spending a lot of time playing defense for this possible catastrophe that might come along, whereas say what you will about the rigidity of the gold standard – you wouldn't have to worry that maybe the dollar's going to lose 90% of its value 3 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Right? So all right, now, devil's advocate, let me try to, you know, obviously I like you, Bob, but let me be hard on you for a minute. Wasn't that hyperinflation going to already happen by now? As the effect of the so-called solution to the crash of 2008 that Ben Bernanke embarked on, all the bailouts and all the inflation?
Well, it is true that some sort of people with loose lips on the Austrian side probably did throw out some predictions the last few years using that term hyperinflation. I personally have been off, but I mean, I never said, oh yeah, we're going to have hyperinflation the next 18 months or anything like that. So I thought you would see prices rising more quickly than they have. But yeah, I mean, I think most of the Austrians have been pretty responsible and just said, this is a bad idea. This is going to lead to a depreciation of the dollar.
For people who aren't familiar with the argument, basically the argument is the crack up boom, right? The argument is the end of dollar hegemony in the world, and all the dollars and all those vaults around the world come in racing home, and $100 bills are worth dimes, and every bit of savings in the country is wiped out, and a massive catastrophe is distribution breaks down, and the division of labor breaks down, and people are really screwed. That's what we're talking about. Weimar Germany is the danger we're playing with, according to you guys, right?
Well, yeah, that's certainly one of the dangers. You know, I mean, so that's the all. I mean, that's the worst thing that could possibly happen is that literally the currency collapses. And you know, and the point is, even if there's only a 1% chance of that happening, if Bernanke didn't do the stuff he's been doing, it couldn't happen, right? Whereas he is opening the door without what he's doing, because then if prices do start escalating, getting out of control, I don't think they're going to just turn an about face and do the right thing. I think they're just going to keep doubling down on it. And so that's really the issue, and the danger is that, you know, once they start down this path, it's going to be hard to turn around.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing, right, is that the last time we had a major inflation, like a real bad one, I guess, like economy-wide, was in the 70s, but the national debt was still low enough that they could turn it around and pay it off, or at least pay it down. They could raise the interest rates, and I mean, if they raise the interest rates now on our $16 trillion national debt, just the interest payment on the debt would be enough to break the entire budget, right?
Yeah, if interest rates spike, among the other problems that it's causing, you're right, is just the federal government's debt, and it's pretty...
So they can't turn it around, is the point. They have no other solution they can think of except to just keep printing money.
And there's that, and then the other issue, too, is the Federal Reserve itself now has a bunch of dollar-denominated assets on its books that are sensitive. If interest rates spike, then the mortgage-backed securities they're holding and all the, you know, treasuries and so on, that, you know, those, the market value of those things will go down. And so in an accounting sense, like if the Fed treated its books the way a regular firm does, the Fed could be bankrupt. You know, its assets would be less than its liabilities. And so it's not that Bernanke's going to just resign then and the Fed's going to shut down, obviously. They're just going to keep printing money because, you know, there's no physical constraint on what they want to do. But I just think that would, you know, sort of make regular people who haven't thought about it before wake up and realize there is something really suspicious with this entity that can be bankrupt and yet they just keep printing money. And so I think that's the thing they're kind of worried about, too, is, you know, if they have to raise interest rates really quickly, it might, as an offshoot, make the Fed insolvent. And I think just for public relations reasons, they probably don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what percent chance is it that you give of a real crack-up boom and a, you know, Ron Paul's warning, the next crisis, the end of the dollar?
I mean, it's... I would be silly for me to throw out a number because that would be meaningless, right? It either is going to happen or it won't.
Well, yeah, you're right. But, I mean, you said, yeah, for the sake of argument a minute ago, in another context, kind of.
Yeah.
You said a 1% chance or something, but I didn't know if you were saying that's what you really thought or whether you thought that, hey, you know, like we just covered, they can't turn it around at this point. They're still going headlong over the cliff right now as their official policy.
Well, I think what they're trying to, what could be going on is, I mean, just think about this in terms of like very long-term strategy. Let me put it this way. If I were in the inner circle and people are asking me, okay, you know, we want to get to get around national sovereignty and we'd really like to have our cadre of influential people, you know, running the world kind of deal, how do we do that? I mean, one thing is you want to break down these national currencies and have it fall under, you know, the IMF or something with a single currency. So that's, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't think necessarily that it's going to be an unavoidable downside of their policies that, oh, yeah, and by the way, we accidentally destroyed the dollar. I mean, it's conceivable to me that they're doing this because that is, you know, in long term part of what, you know, helps people who want to gain more power for themselves. So I guess what I'm saying, if they really did want to turn around, they could, and it would just cause a lot of pain. I mean, just like it'd be like Volcker did in the early 80s, but times 10, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's not literally impossible at this point. It would be really painful, and it would cause, you know, everyone would get wiped out, all the banks would collapse and things like that. But I don't see them doing that, and I'm thinking maybe it's not even a trade-off in their mind. Maybe that this is, according to a few people, what they want. Maybe they don't like the fact that there's all these national currencies, and it would be so much more convenient if they had, you know, the IMF issuing a currency that everybody in Europe and the U.S. and Canada and Mexico all used. Hmm. And so how would you do that? You could never get Americans voluntarily just to say, oh, yeah, sure, let's use the Amero and turn in their dollars, but you could do it if the dollar's crashing. That would then be a panic situation.
And yeah. Hey, look, know, everybody, a new currency we can use that they gave us. Thanks, politicians.
Right. So, I mean, if you're asking me, well, gee, how likely do you think? I mean, I have no idea because these people don't invite me to their conferences, so I don't know. Yeah. But I'm just throwing that out there for your more conspiratorial listeners that it's possible to me that if it does happen, it won't be like, oh, they gambled and lost. Maybe it would be, yep, just like they wanted to happen. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, well, you got to give at least a 45% chance or something, right? All right, we're over time. Thank you so much for your time, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Everybody, that's the great Robert P. Murphy. Consulting by RPM.com is his website, /blog for the blog there. You can find him at the Mises Institute and at Amazon.com, his book, or whatever, wherever you'd like to buy your books. They are The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism and The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. And did I say Mises.org? All right, we'll be right back. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. Ah, there's a good way to get you to go to my website. Soon, at scotthortonshow.com, you'll be able to listen to all of that interview with Robert Murphy that just ran into the commercial break because I couldn't stand to interrupt him. ScottHortonShow.com, I don't know, in a few days. There'll be a Bob Murphy interview for you there. Won't run on antiwar.com because it just wasn't anti-war enough, sorry. But that's all right. Kelly Vallejo, she's anti-war enough. She writes for antiwar.com, and she's on the line. Welcome back, Kelly. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here, and I was watching the general. I missed the beginning of it where probably most of the fun stuff happened, but I was watching the generals testify about the AFPAC war on Capitol Hill yesterday morning, and I thought of you. Time for us to catch up and get a progress report on the success of the surge in Afghanistan. Were you terribly impressed?
Not really. I mean, it was reminiscent of a lot of the, or most of the generals, you know, what do I say, dog and pony shows, or, you know, their typical, you know, smoke and mirrors that they present to the Congress, you know, biannually, or twice a year, rather. And I really didn't see a lot of there in terms of any, you know, breaking news in terms of the progress. Just a lot of the same old language, a lot of the same old rhetoric, their members of Congress haven't done much in terms of pushing back, so weren't so too surprised at that either. But you know, it gave me a sense that everybody's really tired of this war. The generals seem tired, the members of Congress seem tired. Nobody seems particularly credulous anymore. You know, what I got out of it is that the military does not want to draw down any more troops after we do this next drawdown at the end of the summer, which will leave about 68,000 troops in Afghanistan plus contractors going into 2013. And the military really doesn't want to reduce anything until 2014. They don't want to talk about gradual or rapid, you know, withdrawal. So I think you're going to see a fight going into the next year, which is going to, you know, just prolong the inevitable. And I think we seem to all understand that, but this timeline just seems to get more protracted as we go on. This will take us, you know, beyond Obama's first term and into a possible next Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny to me that, I don't know, you talked about the atmosphere of the Congress, how they don't really seem into it anymore. It's not like they're all, you know, beating on their lapel pins and demanding we see this thing through in those kind of stark tones, or not very much. I might have missed it if a couple of Republicans said that, but didn't seem to be very much excitement in the room about it or anything like that. But then again, you know, we're not arguing about you know, appropriations for D.C. sidewalks or something here. They're talking about a war. And yet they go from gung-ho to kind of disinterested rather than against it, you know?
Right, exactly. And, they're, you know, as we know, Scott, they're always inclined to believe what the generals are saying. You know, there's this... There is this feeling that they have to defer to the generals, and if the general is telling them that the Afghan troops are being built up and are more capable than ever, and that there is a good relationship between the Afghans and the U.S. soldiers in the field, and that things are progressing, and the Taliban is being their momentum has been stopped. All of the tropes that we've heard before.
Uh-huh.
Most of these members of Congress are inclined to be to believe that, whether it be out of this inferiority complex they might have, this whole idea that the military is not only stronger but it's smarter on these issues, and they tend not to push back. You know, you have somebody like that would push back. You know, somebody with the personality of John McCain does tend to push back, but what's he pushing back on? He's pushing back on, why aren't we putting more troops in?
Right.
Why aren't we bombing more? You know, so you know, we have Ron Paul, and you know, we have a few others in the Congress that have questioned the war, but on the most part, they listen, they ask some questions, some tough questions. But there's not a lot of good follow-ups if you watch these hearings. And it's very frustrating as an audience member to be listening and going, well, just ask that. You know, say why. What do you mean? What proof do you have? You know, it's very difficult.
Right. Well, and you're right that they just talk in, and how much room there is for the follow-up questions there, really.
Yeah.
Because of... They talk. There's this ad we run here on LRN in rotation. It's an Onion Radio news ad about the new Pentagon spokes drone that speaks in these cliches. It says, "Yes, we're taking the fight to a number of enemy sanctuaries," but it doesn't really mean anything. And you,
right. This
is right as you're saying. This is right when the congressman is supposed to say, "Oh yeah, well, in what province did you do what on what day and where and how much and how successful was it and how long did it last and oh yeah, who's in charge there that I can ask him if you're telling the truth about." There's no any of that. It's all just, wow, a number of sanctuaries, huh? That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, what I think the members of Congress were most interested in listening to hearing in this case was, you know, the aftermath of the massacre and the aftermath of the Koran burning and how that was affecting sort of the relationship of not only the troops and the Afghan forces, but also our relationship with Karzai and moving forward. And so the military, you know, the general was going into the message management mode, which that's been their chief occupation since the war started, is how is the war perceived on a domestic front? How can we manage the message so that we will gain the support to keep this war going? So if you have an entire hearing that's crafted around trying to make Congress feel a little less ickier about what we've seen happen in Afghanistan in the last month, you know, you're going to come out of it feeling like you don't have a lot of new information. You just been listening to a lot of spin for the last time. I'm reading General Allen's statement here, and it's really only about 6 or 7 pages, double spaced, and it just talks about how the Afghan security forces have expanded to 330,000. Yeah, fine. I mean, how many? You got 330,000 bodies. How many of them turn up for work every day? How many of them have come back after, you know, vacation? You know, how many of them would you want to have you side by side in a battle? You know, but they do this. They throw out a lot of numbers. You know, it's like, you know, the kill lists. You know, it's just a lot of emptiness. I don't think anybody's room.
Well, now, did you find out
after it?
Did you find out anything about, you know, I don't know, ongoing projects, specific projects like, say, you know, Margin, Kandahar, things like that, where, remember when we told you it was going to work? Well, see, this is an example of something that we've been doing that's working well. Was there anything that specific in there?
I don't think so. I remember hearing a bit about that when one of Petraeus's last briefings with the Congress. And, you know, Scott, they talk in such vague terms. You know, they'll talk about this new market opening up, or the traffic on a street that had been previously deserted because of all the violence is now hustling and bustling. But, you know, if you're a real student of this, you go on the Internet and Google around, you'll find out what the, you know, where the gray areas are and how things are really, you know, faring. And I think, and I've said this in articles before, at the beginning of the coin surge into Afghanistan, you know, all of the experts said, we will determine whether this is successful or not if the local population is protected. If the local population isn't dying, isn't injured, can go out of their homes, can go out of their, about their business. And if we can, if we're continuing to hear about bombings, IEDs, battles, night raids, so on and so forth in places like Kandahar, which was supposed to be the crown jewel of the coin operation, then we know that things haven't progressed the way that General Allen is trying to convince our Congress that it has.
Yeah, you and your medium-term memory. Why do you always got to bring up old stuff? All right,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Kelly Vallejos, hold them responsible. We'll be right back. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Kelly, Kelly B. Vallejos. I don't know how I got tripped up on that. Easy enough to say. She writes for antiwar.com and the American Conservative magazine. And fortunately for us, not for her, she lives in Washington, D.C., so she writes about what they talk about at all these war party conferences and all that fun stuff. Great fly on the wall for us. And yesterday, of course, the generals, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy, and the head general in charge of the Afghan war testified before the Congress, the House of Representatives, I believe. And I wonder, Kelly, and of course she writes all about the counterinsurgency doctrine, the whole strategy for the Afghan war and how well it's working out or not so much over these past few years. And I wondered whether, did anybody ask any serious questions about the assassinations or murders of American officers and contractors and so forth by Afghans, the so-called green-on-blue violence, if I don't have those colors switched around, or were there any questions about the kill team, the urinating on the dead bodies, the burning of the Qurans and the massacre and these kind of sort of gray swan events, I guess. Things like these are to be expected in a war, but they are sort of singular events that really shock everybody and captured, obviously, the attention of the people of Afghanistan. Were any of the congressmen asking serious questions of the DOD on these issues?
Well, I didn't see the whole thing, so please forgive me, Scott. I didn't hear about the violence on our soldiers by Afghan soldiers, any questions about that, but that doesn't mean that they didn't occur. And I can try to look through the transcript while we're talking. There were plenty of questions about what we saw with the Quran burnings and the massacre and what that means for the greater mission and how it's going to compromise our mission there, about whether or not our soldiers are safe, and you know what kind of relationship they have with the Afghans, because they're hearing all of these stories about how the number of our soldiers who have been shot and killed by Afghan trainees over the last year, they've been hearing these numbers have slowly trickled out into the mainstream. But as we were saying before, the follow-ups, I mean, they only are willing to go so far. So if they say, well, how is the relationship, or should we be worried that these Afghan trainees are fragging, you know, their American or their NATO trainers? And then General Allen turns around and said, well, the large relationship is great. They, you know, our Afghan soldiers are wonderful. We've been training them. They're learning lots of things. We think they're going to be able to take over security next year. We're on the timeline is in place, and we're keeping to it, and we all this confidence. You know, most members of Congress do not say, yeah, but. You know, they usually go on to their next question. And if you listen to these briefings or these hearings long enough, you realize that most of the time they're reading questions that have been typed up by their staff. So they're not a lot of wiggle room for follow-ups there. And it's really pathetic. Because
right, it's because they don't care enough about the issue to have even worked with their staff on what we're going to ask them today at all.
Right, so they'll just go to the next question. Okay, now about this, you know, and it's
right, they're reading their lines for the C-SPAN TV show.
Right, exactly. And you always can tell which member of Congress really knows their stuff and which one had just been handed this paper full of questions, which is usually very insightful questions and very intelligent questions. And you wonder, like, you know, how sad it is that the staffers are usually smarter than the member of Congress. And they're, you know, it's like you want to put them in the spotlight and pull them up in front of there to ask the questions instead of this, you know, this puppet up there, this member of Congress with their perfectly coiffed hair and their silly jokes. And, you know, I was watching the British Parliament last night. They had some excerpts from this on, I think it was, I can't remember if it was on PBS or C-SPAN or what I was watching. And, you know, these guys have to go up there. They have to craft an argument. They have to deliver the argument, and then they have to take questions, hostile questions from the opposition, and they got to think on their feet, and they got to defend their point of view, their position. And
yeah, they have to stand there and be heckled.
Heckled, you know, and their feet are literally put to the fire. Whereas you look at our Congress and everybody's so, you know.
I'd trade him for a queen in a parliament right now.
No.
Let's shake hands on the deal, and we'll just get rid of them. We'll ship them off to England and trade.
But we don't demand that our members of Congress need to be smart or intelligent or articulate. I mean, they just need to spiel off rhetoric in a somewhat charismatic way. But that doesn't mean they have a firm grasp of the issues or are able to convince the electorate of why their policy position is the right one. And this, it doesn't help that the Republican Party has been demeaning intellectualism for the last several to 10 years since the Bush administration. So they keep electing people who are anti-intellectual, you know. What does that do to the gene pool in the Congress? You know, they're just a bunch of speech makers at this point.
Yeah, makes them dumber than they already were even.
Yeah, and then you get a general up there, and he's talking his business. And he's telling you that this is how it's going. We're sticking to a timeline and everything's groovy, you know. And they're going, oh, okay, because they don't know where to take it from there. You know, everything's politicized, so they either agree and they suck up to the general if they're a Republican, or they suck up to the general and maybe ask some fey follow-up questions if they're a Democrat. But really, they don't have the guts. They don't have the intellectual vigor to get to put this guy right on the spot.
Well, and he wasn't all that impressive. He made this big fake smile every time he lied. It was pretty obvious. It seems like anybody, you know, his lies, as we were talking about, weren't very impressive or detailed or anything. Anybody, you could have, if you were in the Congress, could have totally thrashed him. Anybody could have thrashed him if they'd you know, actually had their act together. But Congress is pretty easy to run circles around.
Right. I don't really think that they respect Congress. You know, it's just another body of people that they have to get through to get their purse strings open, you know, and to move on with their war.
Right.
And I think that plays itself out in any of these books by Woodward or Michael Hastings, you know, the operators. You know, they could care less about these civilian, you know, planners and the civilian purse holders. You know, so when they go up in front, the disrespect is not disrespect, but they just sort of They have really no, I guess respect is a good word.
Right.
Well,
none of us do.
It's
just really dangerous that they don't. That's the problem.
Yeah.
None of us should. It's just that they don't. It's scary if they just decide, you know what, Congress, how about we'll just be the Congress. They can do that.
Yeah. I mean, they don't. Yeah. It's like.
Like in Mali today. We're the Congress now. We're the president.
Right.
The colonels take over. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time. I'm sorry we're all out of time.
Well, thank you.
It's great to talk to you again, Kelly.
Appreciate it.
Kelly B. Vlahos, everybody. The American Conservative Magazine and antiwar.com. We'll be right back after this. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Our next guest is Lawrence Wittner. He's an award-winning American historian, writer, and activist. He is professor of history emeritus at SUNY Albany, and his latest book is called Working for Peace and Justice, Memoirs of an Activist Intellectual. His website is lawrencewittner.com, and he's got this great piece at commondreams.org called Try a Little Nuclear Sanity. Yes, please. Thank you. Welcome to the show. Lawrence, how are you?
Fine, Scott. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us here. I would like some nuclear sanity. Thanks for
so
offering.
So would I.
Yeah. There's a thing called the SANE Act. What a great name for an act, assuming it's not like the Patriot Act. It's actually pushing something insane. But I'll take it for face value for now. What do we got here?
Well, it's legislation introduced by Congressman Ed Markey of Massachusetts on February 8th of this year. It's the Smarter Approach to Nuclear Expenditures Act, H.R. 3974, and it would cut $100 billion from the U.S. nuclear weapons budget over the next 10 years. By reducing the current fleet of U.S. nuclear submarines, delaying the purchase of new nuclear submarines, reducing the number of ICBMs, delaying a new bomber program, and ending the nuclear mission of air bombers. So basically, it calls for a major cutback in the U.S. nuclear weapons budget, which is a very large budget.
Now, how much is it per year? $100 billion over 10 years. So I guess, you know, if we extrapolate it out and assume that it's, you know, evenly spread, $10 billion a year. But what is the total nuclear weapons budget every year? Do you know?
Well, it's something like $60 billion. That's money spent not only on maintaining current nuclear weapons and replacing them with more modern weapons, but also with maintaining and indeed building new nuclear weapons labs at a tremendous cost. One of the compromises that the Obama administration made with a Republican opponents of the New START treaty a year or so back was that he would spend a lot of money, over $100 billion of government, federal government money, on building up the nuclear labs, building new ones, and getting ready for a new surge of nuclear weapons. So that basically the government, despite talk of the goal of a nuclear-free world, is looking into the distant future in terms of maintaining and upgrading its nuclear weapons program.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I'm sorry, I don't remember if I read this in your article or where I read somebody saying that Russia is now being brought into the missile shield. I guess, you know, the excuse was that, well, this is to protect Poland from Iran. So the Russians, I guess, are calling our bluff and saying, oh, okay, well, we want to help protect Poland from Iran, too. Since it's not about Russia at all, you won't mind. And I wonder, did they get away with kind of with calling our bluff on that? And are they, in fact, being brought in? Do you know?
As far as I know, they're not. The Russians certainly have made that point, that if the U.S. government needs this missile defense shield to defend Europe against Iranian missiles, then the Russians would be glad to cooperate. But the U.S. government won't go for that and insists on having a missile defense shield that it controls and the Russians have no part of.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so there's a real a conflict between Russia and the United States as to this missile defense program, and it's not going away.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it even fair for us to call it a missile defense program? Maybe it's kind of one, or maybe you have an opinion about this. It seems to me like it's not a missile defense program. It's just one part of the first strike posture, where We're trying to build up such, at least, you know, in the minds of our, you know, war commanders, such a ability to overwhelm the Russians that the mutually assured destruction balance is thrown off. And now it's only assured that we will destroy them and we'll be able to shoot down enough of their nukes on the way up, or that kind of thing, you know, with our airborne lasers and our satellite weapons and whatever, where we would be able to succeed in a first strike. And I don't know how many cities they think is acceptable or whatever, but that's really what they're going for, isn't it? It's first strike capability and to cancel out Russia's ability to credibly deter us?
Well, that may be what the U.S. government is going for. It's hard to fathom motives. Certainly, it would give the United States, if it worked, which is quite questionable, but if this missile defense system worked, then it would give the United States an advantage, since it could neutralize a Soviet nuclear deterrence of the United States and allow the United States to have a first strike or a more effective first strike against the Soviet Union. For many years, people have debated this whole idea of missile defense, called during the Reagan years Star Wars, and the defenders of the system say, well, it's merely defensive. It's not aggressive in any way. But the critics of the missile defense system say that it's part of warfare. That is, just as soldiers of old would carry not only a sword but a shield. So this shield enables the swordsmen to fight more effectively in the future conflict. And therefore, when discussing defense and offense, you have to take into account the fact that a shield will help with warlike behavior.
Well, I'm kind of amazed by this whole thing. You know, when I was elementary school age in the 1980s, it was still the Cold War, and it was sort of, you know, detente was over, and it was the renewed brinksmanship of the Reagan years. And it seemed like at least some kind of probability we could actually get into a full-scale humankind extinction-level nuclear war with the USSR. And yet, the USSR has been gone for more than 20 years now, and it just seems like it couldn't be. Like, we must be stuck in the wrong dimension or something if we still have thousands of these things pointed at each other when Soviet communism is over and the Russian military, you know, pulled back behind the Ural Mountains and set all their satellites free. Well, most of their satellites free. It's just... I guess it was even the Secretary of Defense's office, Robert Gates's office, put out this report saying we really only need 14 H-bombs, and we could bomb, you know, Beijing and Moscow and Paris and whoever we need to deter, we'd have plenty. Tehran?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly clear that the current nuclear weapons budget and nuclear weapons arsenal that the United States maintains is part of Cold War thinking. That is, there's been no upgrading in thought since that time, no understanding that it's time to reassess what's going on in the world. So Congressman Markey, at the time of introducing the Thane Act, said America's nuclear weapons budget is locked in a Cold War time machine. And I think that's true.
Well, let's pick this up on the other side of the break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Lawrence Whitner. He's got this great piece at commondreams.org. Try a little nuclear sanity. All right, y'all. Welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up, the interview I recorded with James Bamford yesterday afternoon. But right now, we're talking with Lawrence Whitner about the H-bomb. And more specifically, about the Thane Act in the Congress, introduced by Congressman Edward Markey, to cut $100 billion. It's a start from America's nuclear weapons budget over the next 10 years. Tell us a little bit more about Edward Markey and how much support he has, how big of a deal this is perceived to be inside the Congress, whether you think it's really going anywhere, those kinds of things.
Well, it's still somewhat marginal, but it's growing in support. There are 45 co-sponsors to this SANE Act. It's been endorsed by a variety of peace groups, and it has the support of the National Council of Churches, the Project on Government Oversight, and the Congressional Progressive Caucus. So it has some possibilities of getting traction in this Congress. Congressman Markey, I should note, has long been a critic of nuclear weapons. He's no newcomer to this cause. And in fact, during the 1980s, he was converted to it by the late Randy Forsberg, who founded Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign, trying to stop the nuclear arms race during the early 1980s. And SANE, of course, was the Committee for SANE Nuclear Policy, running from the late 1950s through 1987, when it merged with the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. So the name SANE Act, I think, is designed to ring a bell with people who remember that history and understand that there's a long-term citizens' campaign against nuclear weapons and saving the world from nuclear war. Scott, are you still there?
Sorry about that. My mic was off. It is interesting, isn't it? I leave it off so I don't interrupt you, and then I forget to turn it back on again when it's my turn. Isn't it strange how the most important issue ever, the future survival of all of mankind, is seen most of the time like the province of some hippies and some elbow patch professors, and nobody else seems to really care or think that this matters as an issue very much. Of course, there's the Friends Committee. But other than that, if you ask people what are the most important issues in America or whatever, getting rid of the nukes is probably 100th on the list or something.
Well, you know, if you ask people whether they would like to get rid of nuclear weapons, they say yes, by overwhelming majorities.
That's
so there's tremendous support for a nuclear-free world. But on the other hand, I think you're right that it's not the issue that's on the front burner or in the front of their minds. They're more concerned about a variety of other immediate matters. So that it's only when a crisis, a nuclear crisis, looms, such as the Reagan administration's threats of nuclear war against the Soviet Union and vice versa, that people get out in the streets and they demonstrate and they join mass campaigns against nuclear weapons. At this point, I think that the nuclear question has receded from the forefront of public debate. But nonetheless, it should be there, since nuclear weapons are the means to destroy the world and all living things.
Well, and you also make a good point in your article, Lawrence, when you say that it's really been the Non-Proliferation Treaty that has done the most, which was, you know, an American-created treaty and pushed by the United States on the rest of the world, that you guys promised not to get nukes and we'll promise to one day get rid of ours, and that it's, for the most part, it's really worked, even if they're trying to use it as a tripwire for war against Iran right now.
Right, right. The United States didn't want that kind of treaty initially. It got together with the Soviet Union during the early 1960s and began to work at a treaty to prevent other nations from developing nuclear weapons, to get the other nations to sign on and say they would not build a bomb. But the other nations said, well, we're not going to sign that sort of a treaty. How about you're saying you'll get rid of your nuclear weapons? So eventually, the a treaty was a compromise and provided, as you said, for the non-nuclear powers to pledge not to develop nuclear weapons, and the nuclear powers to swear that they would get rid of theirs. So naturally, the nuclear powers have been dragging their heels ever since, and they don't really want to get rid of them. But when pressed, they're willing to make some progress on that score. So, in fact, this agreement has worked somewhat. There are far fewer nuclear weapons in the world today. There are about 20,000 of them still remaining, as compared to the height of the Cold War, when there were some 70,000 in existence. But nonetheless, those last 20,000 are going to be abandoned only with great reluctance by their possessors. So the struggle goes on, and I would suggest that your listeners, if they're really concerned about the future survival of the world against this nuclear menace, should contact their members of Congress and urge them to get behind the SANE Act and other measures that will get rid of nuclear weapons for good and for all.
Yeah, I can imagine with my imagination a bunch of congressmen being shocked to find out that, wow, did you guys get a bunch of phone calls about this SANE Act today? Me too. Isn't it shocking all of a sudden how many people are getting behind this issue that we usually don't hear people about? Wouldn't it be nice if we could shock them a little bit and get some of those phones to ring, get some of those congresspeople to at least take notice?
Right, right. I think so. It really has been popular pressure that's led to arms control treaties, such as the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but also to the other nuclear arms and disarmament treaties. Without that popular pressure, governments are not going to move on this score. Governments drift very easily, as we know, into war, especially when they have very powerful weapons. So they become very dangerous at that point. And therefore, the only way we can ensure that they don't fight nuclear wars is to force them to get rid of their nuclear weapons.
Right.
Otherwise,
yeah, I saw a thing on the Science Channel or something or other years ago, Discovery Channel years ago or somewhere, some mathematician said, well, I'm a mathematician, and as long as there are thousands of nuclear weapons in the world, then there's a probability greater than zero that they will be used at some point. And that seemed like a convincing enough argument right there to get rid of all of them.
Right, absolutely. Terrorism is a danger, and Iran developing nuclear weapons is a danger. But those are dangers that would not exist in a nuclear-free world. So only by getting rid of nuclear weapons and the materials for making them will we ever be safe from nuclear war.
Well, you know, even though I was bashing him earlier for his brinksmanship, Ronald Reagan, even though he failed to pull it off because apparently he believed in the myth of Star Wars under 80s technology, but anyway... he believed that he was on some kind of mission from God to abolish nuclear weapons, to make a deal with the Soviet Union to get rid of all of them. And I guess then, you know, use our moral superiority to insist on the abolition of the rest of the nukes on Earth, too, in the hands of the Europeans and the Chinese and the Israelis, etc. But he blew it and he didn't pull it off. But maybe the anti-nuclear activists could improve their spin a little bit if they adopted and used Ronald Reagan as their mascot and had Ronald Reagan's face on all of their propaganda and said, we must create a nuclear weapons-free world like Ronald Reagan wanted. Then that way you're attacking the right from the right and you're showing the broad-based bipartisan consensus on this issue. Think of all the space between you, Professor Whitner, and Ronald Reagan. We all agree on getting rid of the nukes. See what I mean?
Well, I think you're right. I think nuclear weapons are not an issue for the right or for the left. They're an issue for all people who value their families and friends and loved ones and don't want to see them consumed in nuclear war. Arms control and disarmament treaties have been sponsored by both Republicans and Democrats, and I think they should be.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Well, right on. Thank you very much for your time on the show today.
Okay. Thank
you. We're sure with you.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. That is Lawrence S. Whitner, professor of history emeritus at SUNY Albany and author of Working for Peace and Justice, Memoirs of an Activist Intellectual. We'll be right back with that Bamford interview after this. All right, y'all. It's Antiwar Radio. Sorry, Zoe, you don't get to talk very much on the show today, dude. We got so many interviews, and now I got to play this Bamford interview that went long. I want to say real quick, I got a friend here in the email saying, you know, now the more I think of it, the more I think you're right, that they shouldn't be running Ron Paul to the right in the primaries. Of course I'm right about that. That's the whole thing about Ron Paul, is all he's trying to conserve is classical liberalism. He's an individualist. He's a Thomas Jeffersonian. He's not the true conservative. He never was the true conservative. In his personal life, the man is very square and has a very solid Dr. Lee character and all that, and that's perfectly fine. But that doesn't make him a right-winger. He's not. Hell, that's what the John Birchers like about him, is what a little tiny little L liberal he is. A real kind of liberal, like back in the days. And anyway, yeah, that's what's so great about Ron Paul, is he's unique. He's changing the whole game. He's not the one consistent conservative Republican or whatever. He's a libertarian. And damn near plumb line. So yes, of course, all of his commercials should be Ron Paul's been right on the war all along. And if that means that you've been wrong all along, then yeah. Sorry, but now it's time for you to get it straight. Change your mind. You know, lead them. And this is obviously Ron Paul's tactic when he gives a speech at the podium. He goes, you know what? We don't need this foreign policy. Let me tell you why. Whether it's Korea or whether it's Iran or whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's any of the different wars. His argument is, no, 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 you're doing it wrong. And he wants your support. He wants you to get it and support him because you get it. Not he wants you to think, wow, he's the one guy who was an officer in the Air Force 50 years ago. But because he's anti-war, and because anti-war is right. Of course I'm right. I wouldn't have said it if I wasn't right. All right. Here's James Bamford.
Does the NSA intercept Americans' cell phone conversations?
No.
Google searches?
No.
Text messages?
No.
Amazon.com orders?
No.
Bank records?
No.
What judicial consent is required for NSA to intercept communications and information involving American citizens?
Within the United States, that would be the FBI lead. If it was a foreign actor in the United States, the FBI would still have the lead and could work that with NSA or other intelligence agencies as authorized. But to conduct that kind of collection in the United States, it would have to go through a court order, and the court would have to authorize it. We are not authorized.
Okay, you've just heard General Alexander, head of the NSA, denying allegations in James Bamford's new article at Wired.com. The NSA is building the country's biggest spy center. Watch what you say. Bamford, of course, is the author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and The Shadow Factory. There's a PBS special about him called The Spy Factory. And he's got a follow-up to this piece in Wired, responding to the NSA chief. NSA chief denies domestic spying, but whistleblowers say otherwise. Welcome to the show, Jim. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks very much, Scott.
All right. Well, I'm very happy to have you here. The articles are, the NSA is building the country's biggest spy center. Watch what you say. And now the follow-up. NSA chief denies domestic spying, but whistleblowers say otherwise. Now, you wrote not just the book, but three books about the National Security Agency. And you cover a lot of brand new ground in your most recent book. But in this piece at Wired, you have brand new sources, brand new named very high-level sources at the National Security Agency spilling the beans. So before we get to all the denials and your refutations, let's go ahead and basically lay out the situation for the people here. Oh,
yeah,
can you tell us
this for all my
who are your whistleblowers? What is it that they let you know?
I thought you were going to run a clip.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me end that a little bit better. So who are your whistleblowers, and what have you learned?
Well, as you said, very high-level whistleblowers and people with their hands on the earphones. One of them was William Binney. He's about as high as you can get when it comes to the technical knowledge of how NSA does its eavesdropping. He was head of the very large 6,000-person organization. He was the technical director for this very large 6,000-person organization in NSA that did the worldwide eavesdropping, and then he became the founder and co-director of the organization at NSA that pretty much was in charge of automating all the eavesdropping capabilities around the world. That was the what they call the SARC, the Signals Intelligence Automated Research Center. And Bill Binney was the, like I said, the founder and the co-director of that organization. And before that, he was the technical director for the organization that did all the electronic spying around the world. So he has enormous credentials. He worked there for almost 40 years, and he was there at the time that NSA began its warrantless eavesdropping, and that was the thing that he just couldn't stand, and he left in protest late in 2001. And in addition to that, I've interviewed Adrienne Kinney, and she was the one of the intercept operators working down in Georgia, and at the NSA's big listening post down there. It's called NSA Georgia, and which is just finished being rebuilt. This now holds 4,000 people. And she was saying how she was directed to eavesdrop on Americans calling other Americans, Americans calling other Americans from overseas. These would be, a lot of times, would be journalists calling their families back into the in the U.S. and having intimate conversations with them. And she was told she had to listen to them and record them and transcribe them. So so you have all that. And then you have the director's denial that they do electronic eavesdropping in the United States today. But one of the things that was really bizarre was the scenario that they created
Hold on one second, because we have time. We certainly want to get to the general's denials and what else you have to say about that. First of all, I wanted to ask, you know, what all in this article, what all have you been told by these whistleblowers that's new? Obviously, they've confirmed a lot of what you reported in your most recent book, The Shadow Factory. Just about, you know, all the mirrors and the storage facility in Utah, for example. You obviously have a lot more information about that. But what's the brand new breaking thing other than just confirmation of what you already knew here?
Well, what Bill Binney did was he explained basically how the whole operation was set up, how many he gave a statistic, how many average phone calls they were taking in a day. It was like 300,000 or something like that. A lot of facts and figures in the article about how many phone calls were eavesdropped on. He said that in addition to that that monitoring room, the secret room they had in San Francisco, the AT&T switch in San Francisco, there was probably between 10 and 20 other facilities around the country and other telecom switches. So he went into a great deal of detail about actually how this was done and where it was done and how much communications were being picked up. So it was the first time anybody's really gotten statistics on the methodology and end result, how much came in. And again, he was spent most of his life doing focusing on the external targets of the United States, eavesdropping on people around the world.
All right, we're playing yesterday's interview of Jim Bamford from after the show. We'll be right back after this. Hey, I'm Scott. We're listening to the interview I recorded with the great James Bamford, author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and The Shadow Factory, in a new piece in Wired magazine. It's also got it's at Wired.com and a follow-up at Wired.com as well.
And he said that
he's talking about his whistleblower
after
here.
9/11, the focus shifted, and they were bringing in lines from within the United States for the first time. And that was enough to make him decide that he didn't want to be a part of it anymore. He said it was totally unconstitutional. And at one point, he held his thumb and forefinger about an inch apart, and he said, we're now this close to becoming a totalitarian society, a turnkey totalitarian society.
Mm-hmm. In other words, if a president wanted to just cancel an election and use this NSA lawlessly, completely against the American people, to clamp down on them, that it would work. That the infrastructure for it has already been built, a turnkey totalitarian state.
Well, turnkey means that the infrastructure's there. It's all there. Right. All you need to do is turn the key, and that's basically what he said. In other words, capability is there, and now you. One of the focuses of the piece is how, for 10 years since 9/11, the NSA has been building this enormous infrastructure, basically pouring tons of money into the building new listening posts, building new capabilities, and then the final piece is this giant 1 million square foot, $2 billion data center in Utah, and it's where all the intercepted data will go, and then it'll be basically NSA's cloud, so that the NSA people at headquarters and at the listening posts around the world would be able to tap into all that information that goes in there through fiber optic cables.
Mm-hmm. Well, you actually have now these charts that show the whole infrastructure of these different data centers, and you go into depth, as you were saying, about the amounts, the petaflops and yottabytes and all these insanely large amounts of information. In fact, could you tell them real quick the one about, I think you're quoting a guy from Google, about all the information, all the, you know, written text and the history of mankind up until 2005, and then they expect to have that much information processed on an annual basis for now, that kind of thing?
Yeah, those statistics, you have to read those in the article, because
it's some mind-blowing numbers, though, for sure.
There are enormous numbers, and when you're getting up into that amount of data, a yottabyte, which is a measure of amount of data, a yottabyte is the largest number that's been created. There is no number after a yottabyte for the amount of data. And the federal government, actually the Defense Department, has been talking about yottabytes of data now in terms of the creation of a yottabyte of data. And that's, if you measured a yottabyte in terms of actual pages, it would be 500 quintillion pages of text. So we're talking enormous numbers here, but the amount of data that goes through the air and the amount of people that are getting internet coverage is just growing astronomically, and then the NSA's job is intercepting this communication. So that's one of the reasons for the data centers. They're getting more and more information. The irony here is that the more information they collect doesn't seem to equate into progress in the ability to stop terrorists. During the 1990s, they missed the first World Trade Center, then they missed the attack on the USS Cole, and then they missed the attack on the East Embassy buildings on East Africa, and then they missed 9/11. And then even after that, when they've been building all this new capability and being showered with more and more money, they missed the underwear bomber on Christmas Day in Detroit, and then they missed the Times Square bomber and so forth. So we're paying billions and billions and billions of dollars for improving this agency, but it seems to be that all we're doing is paying it to drown itself in data.
All right, now, one thing I wanted to try to get straight here, if I could, was the time frame on what your whistleblower is telling you, because I guess it's possible that a denial could take the form of saying, well, yeah, but that was during the Bush years, but then Congress passed this FISA amendments, and it's not altogether clear, I don't think, how the FISA Amendments Act works exactly, but something like instead of authorizing specific warrants for specific people, the FISA court can now authorize entire kinds of data to be swept up, that kind of thing. So I just want to make sure that I understand you right, that you're telling me that the completely unhinged, illegal version of this in the Bush years is still the same thing that's going on to this day.
Well, as I mentioned in the article, Penny left at the end of 2001, so that was during the time with it was under the Bush administration. He's kept in touch with other people at the agency since then, but that's why I put those timelines in there. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, the FISA Amendments Act, which was passed by Congress after the eavesdropping was exposed to the NSA, it didn't really stop that from happening at NSA. What it did was largely codify what was going on there. So there could be some change. There could be some differences in it. But the point was that the legislation weakened the protections. It weakened the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. As you mentioned, they no longer have to do the kind of oversight that they used to do. And the NSA is building a data center to put something in there, and they're getting a great deal of information from all these inputs that they've got around the country, the one in San Francisco and the other one. So, it's very interesting what could be going in there, and they're certainly from people that have worked in the listening post and so forth said that NSA had a large concentration on trying to find domestic targets. Again, this was after 9/11 when we were attacked by people in the United States, so there was a heavy drive to find any more homegrown terrorists.
Mm. Well, so at this point then, is it just not believable to you when they say that, he was saying that in the denials yesterday, the general was saying, well, you know, we don't even really have the ability to read a domestic email from an American to an American. We would have to, if we thought something was going on, we'd just tell the FBI about it, and they would have to go, I guess, you know, with gumshoes and a trench coat and hand deliver a warrant to a local ISP and have them give up some stuff. But we're helpless in that circumstance. That was just believable or not at all, or what?
Well, you know, if you look at the history, and I have written, you know, the history of 3 books on NSA, going back, that's all the NSA ever seems to do, is deny things that eventually come out as being true.
All right, we'll be right back with more of this James Bamford interview recorded yesterday afternoon on Antiwar Radio right after this. All right, we're listening to the Bamford interview from yesterday, recorded just after the show ended. Where we left off, he said, the NSA, well, they've done nothing but deny things that are true throughout the existence of the agency, and I think this is the part where he starts listing a bunch of examples.
First one was Operation Shamrock, when they were eavesdropping, actually getting copies of all the telegrams coming through the country for 30 years illegally, totally without a warrant. Then they began doing eavesdropping on anti-war protesters, again, totally illegally, during the Vietnam War. And then you had that long period where you had the FISA court in operation, and everything seemed to be going good. And one of the books I did I mean, I'm trying to be fair with NSA. Of the three books, one of them, NSA had a book party for me or a book signing for me at NSA.
Mm-hmm.
Then after 9/11, that's when NSA took off the gloves and it began doing the illegal eavesdropping. And during that time, while that was going on, before the New York Times made the announcement or broke the story about it, Bush got up and said on television in front of an audience, we were giving a speech at one point. Somebody had asked him a question, and he said the United States would never eavesdrop anybody without a warrant. This is at the time that was the height of Stellar Wind, the warrantless eavesdropping program. So it's very hard to say. And if you're looking at that denial from General Alexander yesterday, you have to look at what was said, how it was said, and what the scenario was.
Right. Scenario that's where I interrupted you before. Please go ahead with that. Sorry.
I'm sorry?
That was where I interrupted you before. I'm sorry. Please get back to that.
Yeah, the scenario was this crazy scenario where it's supposed that Dick Cheney became president, and then people were making fun of him because he shot somebody in the face with his shotgun, and Cheney wanted to know who these people were that were making fun of him because he wanted to waterboard them. So, I mean, it was a bizarro scenario, and then the answers didn't really make any sense either because most of them were very parsed or garbled, or they didn't really fit the question. So that's sort of what's been happening with NSA. It tries to parse these questions so that it sounds like they're saying nothing is going on, but in reality, there is something going on. For example, he always hedged his answers by saying, does NSA have this capability to eavesdrop on this information? And he would say, no, it doesn't, not in the United States. Well, you know, that means I can maybe eavesdrop on it with a satellite up in space or on a undersea cable or by eavesdropping on it from Canada or Britain. All these things are things that the NSA has done, and it's, you know, certainly a way. The problem is there's no borders on information these days, no borders on digital communication. So it's not as though, you know, the information is going to stop, the U.S. communication is going to stop at the border or whatever. So you have to take all those things into consideration. And what I suggested in this little piece I just did for the website on Wired,
mm-hmm.
Was that you get all these whistleblowers. You get Benny and Kimmy and another one that I interviewed, David Falk, who was also a whistleblower from NSA Georgia, and said and confirmed basically what Adrian Kenney said. You get all these people, put them under oath, put them on a panel, and let them have their say in front of the Congress, and then mm-hmm. have NSA respond to them instead of coming up with some crazy scenario about people being eavesdropped on who are making fun of a vice president for shooting people in the face. Or I guess
right.
The scenario made Cheney a president, which is scary enough as it is without the shotgun. So that's one way. The public is not allowed to know what's being done with its communications, and that's a very frightening thing. I think the public should know. You know, if the NSA has access to your communications in a democracy, they should have that right to know, and especially when digital communications these days are so prolific and everybody puts everything on digital communications, what pages you're looking at at a book, what pornography you're looking at on the web, what website you're going to, who you're talking on your cell phone, who you're tweeting, and all these pieces of information. So much information goes out from humans these days that any agency that has enormous capability to intercept it and store it and analyze it should be accountable to the public. And for decades, it hasn't been accountable to the public, and the Congress has been basically its cheerleaders as opposed to the acting as the buffer between the agency and the United States citizens.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a common reaction that I've witnessed at least a few times, and it makes sense, is that, well, there's just no way they could be spying on all of us, especially those of us who are just going about our day-to-day lives. They would need half the population to be their employees to sift through all everybody's email to find out who they wanted to persecute. And so pretty much if you have nothing to hide, you don't have anything to worry about kind of attitude still can prevail. How could it be that the National Security Agency is surfing on all this data rather than just drowning in it, as I think you put it in your book, or quote someone putting it that way in your book?
Well, both in the book and the article, I don't make any allegations that NSA eavesdrops on everyone everywhere at all times. I mean, that's just technologically nonsense. So the way it's done, and the way I explain it in the book, and the way it's come out, is they have inputs come into the United States, and if you put these things called NARS devices, they're very fast, what they call deep packet inspections. As the information travels through the routers coming into the country and going through the country at these big AT&T switches, the information is sifted through these. And you can think of it as a big sift, these NARS devices that are looking for particular words, particular phrases, particular names, email addresses, and when it hits that, it's able to get the entire content of that document, all the information, the content of that email. And the idea is once it flags that information, it sends that off to a copy of it, a duplicate copy, off to NSA. That was the whole purpose for these NARS devices, is to be able to do deep packet inspection. And so, you know, you're not looking at every single, NSA is not looking at every single communication. You have a filtering device that filters out who they're looking for and what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people probably picture like the Simpsons movie where there's this one room with 100,000 NSA spies at cubicles sitting there listening. You know what I mean? That kind of thing.
Well,
but it's really not necessary.
I mean,
it's all just in the software to comb through looking for what they're looking for, huh?
Well, you have different levels of software. You have the initial level, probably the satellite, probably the initial level where it'll pick only certain communications frequencies up. It might not, you know, need all the communications coming in and out of Liechtenstein or from Monaco or someplace. But it would want everything going in and out of Libya, or it would want everything going out of other countries. So there's filtering mechanisms, filtering software on the satellite itself that will determine which communications to pick up and which not to pick up. And then once it picks up that, or actually relays it to an NSA...
All right, more James Bamford after this. Santel War Radio.
In the article, I describe how all that works.
Hey, Zoe, guess what?
What's that?
My friend George emailed me and asked if I had any advice for what he could say in his pro-Ron Paul speech at the caucus in his state coming up. And so I just wrote a little pro-Ron Paul speech. It's pretty good. I'm not going to tell you what it says, though, because I'm going to finish playing this James Bamford interview.
And then there's another filter. Well, they'll go through maybe the an initial scan to see what may be important and what's not. And so eventually it will get to analysts at NSA headquarters that will be subject area experts, and they'll have a final look at it and take a look at the final amount. By then, a lot of the other information has been filtered out, just like separating the wheat from the chaff. So so that's pretty much how it works.
And it works well. Is that your understanding, that they basically can surf on all this data and figure out what it is that they're looking for?
Well, the software looks true. It's just like there's software that's designed to find out whether you're downloading a movie or downloading pictures or downloading email. I mean, all this has a signature when it goes through, when it's being transmitted and so forth. So, you know, on a much more detailed level, that's right. What this hardware and software does. It looks for what the agency is looking for. The agency can, if you have this device set up in San Francisco, for example, where it will filter everything through this device, it would be able to kick out whatever the NSA is looking for, and the NSA could program it and reprogram it and change the program, change the targets remotely. They don't have to be in San Francisco in a little room to do it. They just program it remotely from headquarters, or, you know, put a particular name down there, a particular phone number, a particular email. And he doesn't have the power to listen to every conversation. What it does is that it's looking for certain phone numbers, and any of those phone numbers that are on the target list will be forwarded to NSA for analysis. It's much more detailed when it gets the email, because it can actually look inside the content of the email for whatever they're looking for, you know, a name, a word, a phrase, a address, whatever it is they're looking for.
All right, now I'm talking with James Bamford, author of Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, The Shadow Factory, a new article in Wired Magazine, and a follow-up at Wired.com, following up on NSA Chief Keith Alexander's dismissal of the allegations in his article yesterday in front of the Congress. I wanted to give you a chance again to tell me about, because it's been a little while. I was hoping you could tell me about the data storage station, I guess it is, down in San Antonio. That was, I think you compared it to the size of the Alamo Dome, which is pretty big. And then it was going to be just a few miles away from a new Microsoft Center. I believe the last time we spoke, they were working on it. Is that thing up and running now?
I think it's just about complete, or it has been completed. It's actually a former Sony computer plant in San Antonio. NSA bought it and converted it into a sort of small version of what they have in Utah. It's almost the size of the Alamo Dome, and it it could probably serve as a backup for Utah if something happened there. It's not as big, but it can hold quite a bit of information. Plus, there are a lot of analysts down there. The way it works is the listening posts that used to be overseas are largely in the U.S. now. So listening posts in Georgia focuses on communications in the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. And in Texas, they focus on Central and South America. But they also have additional people that watch the Middle East from there. And then in Hawaii, they have what they call NSA Hawaii, which looks at the Far East and so forth. And then there's a facility in right outside of Denver in Colorado that is the downlink for all the satellite information. In other words, poor satellites around the world pick up these communications and then retransmit it down to Aurora, Colorado, Buckley Air Force Base, and then that's, like I said, another filter, and then from there it goes, or it will go to Bluffdale, the NSA facility in Utah.
And you said that they really have made significant advances in the speed of the computers that they use to crack even the toughest new encryption methods. Is that right?
Yeah, that's another new thing. I mean, you know, the article, a fairly long article, the quoting Binny about the domestic aspect is just one small part of it. The other aspects deal with how big the data center is, what kind of, basically describing the whole data center, what it's basically going to be made up of, how many square feet of storage space and all that. and how that will be sort of the final piece in this puzzle. But the other aspect of the data center is not just the storage, but breaking codes. NSA has three basic jobs. One is intercepting communication. The other is breaking encryption systems, breaking codes. And the third is making encryption systems for the U.S. government. So on that second part, if you're breaking codes, you need two real, it's very important you get two things. One of them is a lot of communication, because what you're looking for are patterns. And if you have one piece of communication, you're not going to find a pattern. If you have two, it's going to be very difficult to find a pattern. If you have 200,000, it's going to be much more easy to find patterns. Mm-hmm. So the more information they store at the NSA data center in Utah, the more they'll have to go through looking for patterns. And what they use, the tool they use to simplify it as much as possible, the main tool they use to look for these patterns through a process known as brute force is very fast computers. Very fast computers will go through zillions of combinations of looking for different combinations within this group of data that they have at at Utah. So, in other words, if they have 200,000 messages from a particular target that's in a particular encryption system, they'll run enormous numbers of combinations through them. Right now, they've developed a computer that will do what's known as pentaflop. It's a measure of speed. A pentaflop is a quadrillion operations a second. And NSA has a computer that will do probably in 5 to 10 petaflops worth of speed, which is probably the fastest computer in the world right now. And it's working on a computer that will do one order of magnitude higher than that, which will be an exaflop. So you're getting in these terms that nobody's ever heard of, and these are just like the land speed record for computers in terms of being able to do very fast analysis. And in order to build this supercomputer, they're building it down in down in Tennessee, at the same place where they, in World War II, built the atomic bomb, down in Oak Ridge. So in World War II, they had this program to build the this ultimate weapon of mass destruction, and now they've got a program to build the ultimate supercomputer down there, the fastest computer in the world. And it's very secret. This is the first time it's come out, this whole any detail at all about this brand-new supercomputer they're working on down in Tennessee.
Oh, really? Good. Well, another feather for your cap. Always incredible journalism for more than a generation now. Jim, thank you very much for your time on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure, Scott.
Good to talk to you
again. Take care.
All right, everybody. That is James Bamford, author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and The Shadow Factory. He's the subject of a Nova special on PBS, which you can watch online, which is all about the science of how they gobble up all this data, called The Spy Factory. And he's got a new piece in Wired magazine, the NSA is building the country's biggest spy center. Watch what you say. And a follow-up at Wired.com. NSA chief denies domestic spying, but whistleblowers say otherwise.